I'm Jim Benson, and you're listening to TV Time Machine on Intelligent Talk, 1170 KCBQ. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and visit our show archives at tvtimemachine.com.
Thanks for your call. Hello, you're on open mic. Would you like to share an opinion with us about the wolf?
I've been listening to your program because I could not sleep.
Would you tell us your name, sir?
You're all fools. That wolf was the only living thing in this city. The traffic did not kill him. He killed himself because he couldn't stand the cage any longer. The tundra you gave him was cement, and the northern lights you gave him were an ugly neon glow. You took the pack away from him, and the only choice he had was to die.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're about to embark on a journey through a vast galaxy that traverses memory, generations, and popular culture. A magical trip through time as we meet the men and women of yesterday and today who have shaped not only what we see on TV, but the way we see ourselves. I'm Jim Benson. Join me, if you will, on an exploration of television's past, present, and future as we climb aboard the TV Time Machine. Our destination subject today will be the classic TV series The Equalizer. Author, writer, and producer on the show, Coleman Luck, will help navigate this particular excursion into the annals of classic television. We'll begin our exciting and fun-filled odyssey right after these brief messages.
Now, you are going to prison for a very, very long time. And if by any strange chance you happen to fall through their net, then by God, I'll be there to catch you. And you will not lie at what I do one little bit.
Today on the TV Time Machine, we travel back to 1985, a year that invited audiences to witness a special type of TV justice, courtesy of a dapper yet dangerous gentleman known as the Equalizer. Our guest today helped breathe life into the character of Robert McCall, writer and producer Coleman Luck. Mr. Luck spent 4 years on the Equalizer and was one of the primary talents responsible for adding depth and dimension to this remarkable television character. A veteran of the Vietnam War, Mr. Luck is also the recipient of a Bronze Star for both valor and service, and is the author of the book Angel Fall, the first of a projected trilogy. Over the next few segments, Coleman Luck will help us relive virtually every aspect of this classic television series and reflect upon his career and life experiences, which shaped many of the Equalizer's finest moments. Again, if you've got a problem and the odds are against you, feel free to answer our ad as we slip from the restraints of the present and into an equalized past. Coleman, thank you for coming on board the TV Time Machine.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Jim. It's good to talk to you again.
Hey, Coleman, as we said at the top of the show, you're a writer, producer, and author. What inspired you to take that direction in life, and how did you ultimately get in the game, as it were?
Well, that's a good question. I think probably most of us who come to Hollywood, I had an old friend who was a producer, a successful producer in Hollywood, who said, you know, Coleman, we all come to Hollywood to be loved, which is probably the greatest mistake that a person could ever make in coming to Hollywood. But I think that a lot of us, you know, we are from somewhere else in many cases, at least it used to be that way. And we come because there's something that drives us here. And I think part of it is that we just don't feel like there's any place for us anywhere else. And that certainly was my case. I grew up in the Midwest in the Chicago area. And, worked in advertising and so forth for several years after the Army, and just didn't feel at home in any of that. And then I was taking a graduate course in film and cinema at Northern Illinois University, and I really discovered, for the first time in my life, I've been involved in advertising writing, but I suddenly looked at film in a different way, and I had never imagined the idea of writing a screenplay. This was all the way back in 1975, and there was no place to, even at that school, which is one of the biggest ones in Illinois, they didn't have a course in screenwriting back in those days. They had tons of courses in film criticism, but, you know, all sorts of things. But I had to stumble along and find my way and write my first script, and I sent a copy of it to two people, just blind. I sent a copy to Pauline Kael, who was the film critic at The New Yorker, that famous, wonderful, amazing, one of the greatest film critics who's probably ever lived.
That's right.
And I sent her a copy of my script. She'd never heard of me. I just sent it blind to the magazine, and she sent me back a note saying, you know, I think you know what you're doing. And I sent a note back to her. I let her back and thanked her for that and said if I could, asked her if I could use her name to get into graduate school in California, and she allowed me to do that. She was very gracious. And so that was it. I sent the other copy to Ernest Lehman, who was the president of the Writers Guild, with a list of amazing credits that go back forever, like Sound of Music and all the rest. And he wrote me back a two-page single-spaced letter and tore my script to shreds and gave me some incredibly important advice on what it, how to write and how to think about your characters, and I was tremendously grateful. So that spurred me on to get into grad school at USC, move my family to LA from the Midwest, and so, you know, that's kind of the way it began for me.
Now, some people may not realize that in addition to your television work, you are a mentalist. Explain that to us, exactly what that means.
Well, a mentalist, and the TV series that's on right now called The Mentalist is kind of a shadow of what mentalism is. It's the idea is that, you know, that mentalism is really mental illusions. It fits into the category of magic, although people view it in a very different way. When I was young, I was a teenager, I got into magic, and like so many kids do, and I performed, and I had a little show that I took around different places, and in fact, I met my wife and when we were seniors, and she was my first assistant, so the magician gets the beautiful girl, that's
right.
The way I look at it. But after the Army, I came back from the Army, and I don't know, I just didn't have the desire to do traditional magic anymore, a little silks and, you know, scarves and boxes and things. I'd had fun with that, but I wasn't interested. In the time, there was, of course, the whole interest in the supernatural and the occult back in the 60s, the late 60s growing up. And I knew about this area of magic called mentalism. Now, fitting into that are things like pseudo-mind reading and all sorts of other what appear to be supernatural phenomena. And I had heard about this, and I knew about it. There was a great, great mentalist that was on TV back in the 50s. His name was Joseph Dunninger.
Oh, yeah.
And I had seen him on TV when I was a kid, and it was amazing. And he was tremendously popular with his TV show. And then, you know, in the late 60s, you had Kreskin, who was a tremendous performer, and who really kind of picked up on what Dunninger had done. And so I got involved in that. I was in my 20s, and my wife and I developed a program that we took around the Midwest called Beyond Reality, and I was actually on TV in Chicago once or twice. And we got involved in doing that, and people view these things very differently, where if I went out and I would do a magic show, such as David Copperfield, I never could have done that. He's so talented, but something along that line, people would look at that and go, wow, that's really an interesting trick. You know, I wonder how in the world he did that. They don't look at mentalism that way, and that's what's strange about it. We use the same principles that magicians use, traditional magicians, but we don't use any of the same trappings. And, we don't have scarves and little animals and all sorts of stuff like that on the stage. Rather, we focus on the mind and we create what appear to be miracles of, you know, of mind reading and prediction or a range of various phenomena. And, you know, and people look at this and they look at it and they think it's real. Many people do. And they think somehow that you have this supernatural ability in some way. You've developed it or, you know, how you got it naturally somehow. I have discovered, and I try to be very, very honest about this, I never tell people how I do the things that I do in a program, but I'm very honest to say, look, what you've seen is an illusion. It isn't real. What this all is a trick. And then I talk about the nature of how we are so easily, we're prone to seeing illusions. And that's a strange thing about us physiologically as well as psychologically. And very easily some of the illusions in our lives can become delusions, and that's where danger comes in. So I take a very different approach. There are mentalists who go the other route, and they'll actually pretend as though they really have power, and they'll do readings for people and do all this sort of thing. I refuse to do any of that. I just, I find that to be dishonest and misleading, and I just won't do it. So now we have a program called Illusions of Power that we take around, and that's where that's been going. And I got back into it again. I should say I got out of it when I came to Hollywood. I just couldn't continue it and raise a family and try to operate in the entertainment business. I got back into it again when I retired a number of years ago, and I've joined and become a member of the Magic Castle in Hollywood, and really enjoying doing this again. It's sort of like going back to my youth, I suppose.
So you're not trying to deceive people. You're deceiving them, and then at the same time, you're showing them the reality of the deception.
I think that's very important. I can't do it any other way. I just, I just find it to be people are searching so much. When you go out and you perform before an audience, you have such a range of people in that audience. Some of the people have lost loved ones, and boy, they would love to think that you can somehow get in contact with their dead spouse or their dead child. I refuse to play that game. And the strange thing is, you can't imagine how forthright and straight out I say what you've seen as a trick. Still, I have had people come up to me afterward and say, "Well, I can't figure out how you did that. You must have some kind of ability and power. I felt something when you said this to me, or something. I just felt something inside." And I said, "Well, whatever you feel or whatever you felt was completely generated inside of you. I had nothing to do with that other than scare you a little bit and give you a little shot of adrenaline, perhaps, but that's it." And, I just can't mislead people on the level of, trying to make them think that I have some kind of special power. I just can't do it.
Well, I think life has a lot of deception. I mean, as human beings, sometimes life can be like living in a house of mirrors, and you have to determine, what is a falsehood and what is the truth. How can people really be sure that reality is reality and the truth is the truth, that they're not being deceived?
Well, that's a really good question. I my own feeling is you start looking around at the things that are projected that come out of quantum mechanics and that whole area of amazing speculation, and more than just speculation about the weirdness of reality, of what we call reality, and how much of it is so completely fluid. And if you start getting into that deeply, you think this whole universe is crazy. But somebody said a long time ago that the real issue of the sort of the philosophical issue of our age is the issue of authority. What authority are you going to choose to guide your life? And that, I think, it was a very perceptive comment. I think that is the issue. And the answer for most people is, well, hey, I'm going to just follow myself. I don't know what else to do. I'm just going to be who I think I can be. And, my own experience now at 66 years old is that I tried that for a while, and it really didn't work very well. I discovered that, I was really not very skilled at being my own little God. So I'm very open about the fact, and I have been forever, that, I'm a Christian, and I've chosen that particular view, and I believe strongly that it is the heart of reality. And so when I talk about reality, it comes from my faith, but my faith is based upon what I consider to be good and sufficient evidence. And, I feel that very strongly. So, I never try to beat people over the head about it, but, and all the time that I worked in Hollywood, my friends, most of whom would never classify themselves as Christians, we had a great time together. We had wonderful debates together, and I love them all dearly, and we disagreed about many things and agreed about some, and my goodness, when we were doing The Equalizer, you can't imagine the amazing and wonderful conversations that we had in the writer's room about all this stuff, because you just can't talk about, you can't talk about story and about episodes forever. You're in a room together for 8 or 12 hours a day sometimes, and you have to break free. And it is unusual, but it's still unusual, I think, for a Christian who is a committed Christian to be really active, in Hollywood in these areas. So it was an unusual experience, because people would find it hard to believe that anybody who was sane and appeared to be relatively rational could view Christianity as true. And, of course, most of those people who had who took that perspective never had really examined Christianity. They sort of equated it with right-wing politics, which I hate seeing happen. I'm very opposed to equating Christianity with politics, and I've tried my whole career to stay away from that. And so they discovered, well, you know, you're not just using Christianity to promote a right-wing agenda, and I'm not. So, you know, I mean, that's where I come from, and, you know, and I've been very open about it, and that influences everything that I do. It influenced every episode that I ever wrote on The Equalizer. It influences everything that I write and have written since then. At the same time, I hope that what I have done is not sort of, just crummy, apparently Christian kind of bad quality work. I'm committed to being unpredictable, let's put it that way.
Coleman, what was the genesis of The Equalizer? How did it begin?
Well, I was not there when it began. The guys who created it, Michael Sloan and Dick Lindheim, they had been friends and had worked on some things in the past. You would have to talk to Michael or to Dick about the absolute genesis of it. I didn't come on until show 11. I know that Michael had been aware, had been friends with Edward. Edward had done a series over in England that was a spy series that had been well received, and he was just a terrific actor. And they had a desire to do something with him, and they wanted to do a series that related to the whole spy world here. I think it was Dick that brought in the name, The Equalizer, that great name that was applied to the series. Michael was only involved in writing the pilot and was involved in that production. Dick was involved in the series as an executive, as I was either executive vice president or senior vice president in charge of television. I can't remember his exact title, but he was not officially a writer. Neither of them wrote anything on the series themselves after the pilot. I believe that Michael wrote the pilot. They shared the created by credit. And then Michael was off doing other things. He was and is a very busy writer, producer, talented man. So it was given over to the hands of other people. And the showrunner of the first year was Joel Cerno. I came on show 11. Jim McAdams had been involved in, I think, producing the pilot and, was involved in the production all the way from the beginning to the end. So the absolute genesis of it, I couldn't tell you what their first thoughts were. I can only tell you what happened pretty much from the time that I came on board.
Well, in the pilot episode of The Equalizer, a young mother calls upon Robert McCall to protect her from a relentless stalker, as we'll hear in the following clip.
Your ad said if the odds were against me, they are. What can you do?
Well, I can equalize the odds, make them more in your favor. Now, I tell you what you'll do. I will give you a number, and you will call that number every hour from 6 o'clock in the morning until you go to sleep at night.
What if I see him?
If you see him, you call. If it's across a crowded street, you call, and I will be there. And believe me, he will never bother you again, all right?
That's all it will take.
That is all it will take.
I'm just so scared.
Colleen, look at me. Look at me. I'm going to take care of you. Really take care of you. No one is going to hurt you. Believe me and trust me.
Coleman, what did Edward Woodward bring to that role?
Oh, my goodness. He brought, I think, both authority and humanity. Edward was just, a wonderful man to work with. You know, as I've written in the past, he both was and wasn't the equalizer. He brought to it a compassion. I think he brought to it a wisdom about the nature of human life. And he was a man himself who had experienced many things. Some of them had been wonderful, and some of them had been difficult. And he brought a kind of, when I say a humanity, I don't know how else to put it, but underneath it all, a kind of broken heart. And, you know, the nature of, you know, of he brought also, I think, the sense that this was he had a father figure about him, a father, the essence of what a father you hope a father would be or could be. And, you know, in a world where fatherhood has failed in many people's lives, he just communicated that. I think it was a natural gift, and part of it was just the way he was willing to integrate his own experiences of every kind into the way he performed and carried off that character and made it real.
Do you think that's why he was so popular with the women members of the audience, that he was that protector, that father figure, that strong figure that really doesn't exist that much, unfortunately?
I think that had a huge amount to do with it. You know, it's sort of like, this is the father who is going to protect you when you need protection, and he will kick you in the tail when your tail needs to be kicked. He's going to tell you the truth. And at the same time, out of that, I mean, he is working out his own demons. He is dealing with his own issues, which are very great. So, you know, the concept, you know, it's a cliche to say sort of like the wounded healer. But in a sense, there was that element about him that I think was very strong. You could just look into his eyes and see that there was anger, there was pain, there was frustration, there was, disappointment. And yet at the same time, there was this iron will that said, you know, I will not allow any of that to overcome me, and I will protect those who are weaker than I am at a given point, and I will try to make them strong. I think that, for me, of course, I believe that is what the role that a Christian should perform in society. Not that he was himself a Christian, no. The character that Edward played of Robert McCall would never have called himself that. But that was the heart of it.
Well, Coleman, we're going to have to take a little break from our fascinating journey, but we'll be back in a moment with producer of the classic TV series The Equalizer, Coleman Luck, who is traveling with us on the TV Time Machine.